Thank you for coming.
Thank you for coming out. Welcome. My name is Dubs Weinblatt. My pronouns are they, them, theirs, and I am so excited for our seventh season of the Thank You for Coming Out podcast. In 2015, I founded the queer improv show Thank You for Coming Out, or TIFCO as we call it, and it was one of the longest running queer improv shows in New York City. In 2018, our beloved improv show became the podcast it is today, hosted and produced by Gay City News. It is an honor and privilege to hold space for the coming out and coming into self stories our guests share. And I'm starting a new little mini series called Catching Up With, and I'm so excited to welcome back my first guest of this new mini series, is what I'm trying to say, Abdi Nazemian. Abdi is the author of Only This Beautiful Moment, winner of the Stonewall Award and the Lambda Literary Award, and Like a Love Story, a Stonewall honor book, and one of Time's 100 best YA books of all time. Everyone, did you hear that? Of all time. He is the author of the young adult novels Exquisite Things, Desert Echoes, The Chandler Legacies, and The Authentics. His novel, The Walk-in Closet, won the Lambda Literary Award for the LGBT debut fiction. His screenwriting credits include the films The Artist's Wife, The Quiet, and numerous television series. He has been a producer, executive producer, or associate producer on numerous films, including Call Me By Your Name, Little Woods, and Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood. He lives in Los Angeles with his husband, their two children, and their dog, Disco. Abdi, hi.
Hi, I'm so happy to be back.
I'm so happy to have you back. I know we were just chit-chatting a little bit, but for our guests, how's it going?
Well, the world
loaded question.
Is falling apart.
Yep.
I think since we look, the world is always complex, and there's never going to be a perfect time, which is the theme of Exquisite Things, my next book, about two immortal boys in love searching for a time where their love isn't a crime. And a lot of the reason I wrote it to remind young people that you never will have a perfect time. The time you get to live in will always be fraught, and you have to find ways to choose love and community and joy, because loving the life we're given is our biggest job, I think. But yes, how I'm doing is I am struggling with the state of the world and how to be an additive member of society, but also really grateful for the connections I have and the community I have, such as you and your collective and this podcast and our broad community of humans. So yeah,
it is. I just, well, we'll get into Exquisite Things in just a second, but yeah, it's tough out there, and I think it's the communities that we have are so important to keep us grounded. I meditate every day, and the app that I use, the Balance app, they have these different, like, quote-unquote courses with different themes, and the theme that I'm working on right now is loneliness and easing loneliness. And today, just today, the framing that the practitioner was giving was that the feelings that you feel in your body when you feel loneliness it's like, instead of looking at them as something negative, looking at them as like a signal of like your body's telling you you need connection. So what can you do to like find that connection? Which I really love that reframe. It's like, oh yeah, like it, because you know, feelings of loneliness can feel really isolating and scary and sad and depressing and despair. And but to reframe it is amazing.
No, that is amazing. And it's funny, I said this to my husband recently, because I'm actually in Atlanta where I've been working for 4 months, and I have gone back home on weekends to see my children and my husband. But like, I think my life is so full with community, especially because my family is my core community and we're always together. Like, I don't think I felt true loneliness since my kids were born. Like, I didn't, and I've been, you know, coming to an apartment that's just me, you know, for a while has been really a lesson in what that emotion is. And so, yeah, I feel like for those who are struggling with loneliness, finding a way to reframe it is so crucial. It's hard.
Yeah.
Loneliness is a
It's so
hard emotion.
hard.
It's a hard emotion. And usually, you know, my life tends to be so full of love and humans and community that, and my beautiful dog that, like, when I am alone, it feels more like solitude, which to me, solitude is like this beautiful thing where it's like you actually want to be alone and you get the privilege of checking in with yourself. Loneliness is a very different thing that feels very hard to navigate.
Yeah. I've been working on, instead of saying like I'm doing things by myself, I'll say like I'm doing things with myself.
Oh,
And
exactly. Yes. Well,
yeah.
that's like, so you take yourself on. Have you done the artist way? Did we talk about this already? We did.
I don't remember. I think so, but I started it and haven't finished it, but I know there's like the dates that you take
Yes.
yourself on, which is
Yes.
like lovely.
So for those who don't, for listeners who don't know, The Artist Way by Julia Cameron is my creative Bible. I absolutely love it. It's a 12-week program in creativity that I think is based on the 12 steps. It feels very rooted in the kind of step work you do. And there's no like writing instruction. It's all about how to be in touch with yourself. And the core principles of it are journaling every day and taking yourself on artist dates, which is like you go alone to something that feeds that creative childlike part of your soul. And when I started doing the artist's way many, many years ago, I found the concept of the artist's days to be so silly. And now it has changed my life. I go do everything alone. Like I go to concerts alone. I go to theater alone. Like it's such a healing thing.
Yeah, I started going to theater by myself with myself and concerts with myself, and I travel a lot with myself,
Yeah,
and
same.
I've really, really come to learn how much I love it. Like I can go when I want, I can leave when I want, I can do it. Like there's no, not that it's not great to have someone to share things with and check in and negotiate, blah blah blah, but like I can do whatever I want, whenever I want. It's so
It's
good.
no, it's the best. And one, you
Yeah.
know, a tradition I started with myself when my children were born was to take, usually it's 2 weeks, sometimes a little less, but a year where I generally go to London, which is the city I find most inspiring, and schedule nothing and do whatever I want. If I want to go to the theater, I go. If I want to go to a museum, I go. I don't plan anything. I try not to see anyone. Like it's so liberating to be with yourself, not by yourself, but to really check in at one time a year where I get to really check in with myself and ask myself, like, where am I and what do I want to say next and what do I want to do next? And usually that's where all my ideas for books come from, is during those trips, because I really like go deep into myself to ask, like, what do you want to express about the world right now?
Yeah, that's lovely. And I wish that, and this is only like my experience, and I'm curious if this is yours, where I think for a lot of queer people, sometimes it's hard to be with ourselves because we don't want to unearth what we have, like the shame or the guilt or the fear of the identities we hold. And it took like a lot, it took many, many, many years for me and stopping drinking, like getting sober, to be able to actually sit in that solitude that you're talking about and like check in with myself and be like, what are the things? And so I think it takes like a lot of work to be able to get to the point of wanting to sit in solitude, like wanting to sit in solitude and enjoying it.
And enjoying it. Yeah. And I will add that if you've done that work, and I think through my life, I've done so much work from therapy to Al-Anon to writing to all of it. But when you've done that work and you can sit with yourself and realize you're not feeling shame anymore, that's such a powerful thing. Because when I was younger, being alone was terrifying. And I would usually need, you know, I would need to escape loneliness through, you know, whatever I could use to escape it, and to now be at a point where I can be with myself and not want to escape myself because I genuinely love myself and want to be in my own company. That's a pretty powerful thing for a lot of queer people who grew up feeling shame.
I love hanging out with myself. We have fun.
Exactly.
It actually is reminding me of a quote that I pulled from Exquisite Things. So let's talk about Exquisite
Ooh,
Things.
okay, yes.
Coming out, I'm showing you your own book, and this is a
Yay.
podcast, so no one else can see it. It's coming out September 23rd. And I was lucky enough to get an advanced copy. And I know I've texted you a little bit of this, but just want to like say to your face how much I love this book, how much I love all of your books, but it not but and this one is just it's so what's the word I'm looking for? Profound, because it goes through time. And like how you said earlier of like there's never a good there's like it's always you just got to find it, you just got to go for it, because there's never a good time for there's always going to be challenges. But okay, so anyways, let me back up. So the quote that I pulled was, "I want to be brave enough to be myself, to live a life of truth," which just is like Gord, it just resonated so deeply with me. And it's like, how can we all be brave enough to defy? And then there's another quote that I'll read real quick. This was their true crime, daring to live when the world needed them merely to exist. It's like just like, with all of the like laws and the regulations and the disinformation about queer people now, I've trying to figure out how to say this, and I feel like I'm like disjointedly rambling here, but like there's a little bit of comfort knowing that this isn't new. It feels new for a lot of people, but like this has existed through history. So anyways, I'm gonna stop rambling and say thank you for writing this book. It's gorgeous. And what was yeah, so you were in London, like what was your inspiration for this particular book? And tell us a little bit
So
about it. You already did a little bit.
I did a little. So the book, just to give listeners a little overview, is a little bit of a riff on Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, which was my favorite book when I was a very young child. And I think I was always at the time obsessed with The Picture of Dorian Gray, in part because the sensibility of it was so queer and the language was so queer coded, but also the idea of like eternal youth was so appealing because I was one of those kids who felt like I was born in the wrong time. You know, like the time that I was in was always like not in sync with who I was. And so I have always been obsessed with the idea of immortality and eternal youth. And there was a moment, I think, when I was contemplating just so much of what's happening right now to me personally in terms of book banning, you know, many of my novels, but particularly a novel I wrote called Like a Love Story, which is about a group of teenagers growing up in during the AIDS crisis of New York in the late 80s and early 90s. And it's about queer activism and ACT UP. And it has been very heavily banned all over statewide in Utah and in districts all over the country. And I've been personally attacked because of it. And like, it's been like, it really made me contemplate this idea of like, how no matter every time as queer people we take a few steps forward in terms of our rights and our ability to be self-actualized, the same exact forces of repression start trying to kick us down and passing legislation to put us back in the closet and criminalize us again. And so I started to just think about this cycle that happens all the time, and it made me think about Oscar Wilde and his trials. And so the idea really came to explore a love story across over a century. It takes place over 130 years about these two boys who are looking for a time where they can just feel free and unashamed, and how every time they get close, they meet that same resistance. And so it zeroes in on a couple of events that I felt were really underexplored. You know, one of the main chunks takes place in Boston in 1920 when Harvard University had a secret court where they put these gay students who they found out were having these queer parties and exploring. There was a whole queer subculture happening in Boston and Cambridge at that time, which I didn't know about. And so, it was a time when these students started to feel liberation, and then the university put them in a secret court, expelled most of them. Three of them died by suicide by the end of their lives. And none of this was unearthed until relatively recently. And then I explore London in the 70s and 80s. And then, of course, I also link it back to the present day and a lot of what's happening in the queer community now, most specifically to trans people, obviously, who I think have been the most targeted by the US government and by the UK government and others. And so, because also a lot of the book takes place in London, which is, as I mentioned, my favorite city. And I dream of retiring in London, and I feel strangely at home there, but I am very aware that the UK, despite feeling like a place where I feel at home, is really horrible when it comes to trans legislation. And that as a young adult author, as an author of children's literature entering the world of the UK, it is, their most prominent children's author, whose name I don't even want to say, as we all know, is using her platform and her power to fund anti-trans legislation and to really lead a movement of hate and of fear. And so I felt really galvanized to tell a story that connected some of what has happened in history to what is happening now, to try and give people both a satisfying love story and a story about community and hope. And it's a yarn, it has a plot, and it has, I hope people get swept up by the characters, but I also hope when they put it down, they contemplate how we should all study history to know how to meet this moment.
Yeah. She who must not be named. So
She
many
No,
parallel things there.
it's terrifying, and it's so upsetting. It's so upsetting as an author, as a I feel such personal, that to me feels very personal because I read all of those books when I was young and really loved all of those books. So that part of it feels hard, but it's also, I always feel like it's very hard to accept that, like, it doesn't surprise me when a politician is hateful because I feel like that's just like what you expect. But when an artist doesn't have empathy for others, that really is always just feels more personally sad to me because I know the work of being an artist is finding empathy and forgiveness for all. Like when you write about humans and characters, you understand that we're all one. And I just don't understand. Like, how did this happen? How? Why? Was she always this way? Like, what the psychology of it is too much for me to make sense of.
Same. Yeah, that's so disappointing. So let's talk. You brought it up while you were talking about exquisite things. I also just want to quickly shout out like a love story. Well, and all of your books explicitly. I just love all your books. But like a love story, when we so the TIFCO Collective is a collective that you're a part of that is featuring previous thank you for coming out guests and fans of the podcast who have all these different skills. We came together at the LGBTQ Center in April in the very room where ACT UP had its first meeting. Which I thought was so significant. You read a little like excerpt from the book when they're in that room, and it just felt really, I just felt so connected to the queer community and to you and the book and the characters and just the resistance that the queer community and the resilience that we have is just, it was a really special moment.
It really was. That evening was so beautiful, and the collective has so many unique and vital voices. And that evening, in addition, it was of course in the room where ACT UP was founded, and I got to read a passage of like a love story that takes place there. But everybody shared a little bit of both who they are and also the work they do out in the world. And it was so inspiring. There are so many people who are doing their part to share their perspective and to create bridges. And I really think, going back to your initial question about how are you, that led to like the world is so
Yeah.
connected. I have to maintain my belief that art and communication are the only way that we're going to get through all this. We have to keep building bridges however we can. And so anytime I'm in a space where I'm meeting people who are going out in the world unafraid to share their perspective, be open to other perspectives, communicate in their own ways, like that is inspiring. Because I do think, we were talking about loneliness and solitude and all that. Like, I've been reading a lot. I don't know if you read M. Gessen, who is an amazing resource on authoritarianism, but they have been writing quite a bit on how when countries become authoritarian, one thing that happens is people kind of shrink into themselves. The way that people deal with a country sliding into authoritarianism is they it's a culture of fear, right? So people, the quote you read about, we wanted to live as opposed to just exist, I think people accept like we just need to exist. We can't live. We have to like shrink into ourselves because we're afraid. We're afraid of what the government might do to us. We're afraid of what how our use of our speech or our art can be criminalized. I mean, I'm going through it right now. The book bans are a very It's a culture of fear. They're attacking us to make us go silent. And as I tell people about book bans, you don't understand that, like, people think that when a book is banned, it sells more. And they're always like, congratulations, you're getting all this attention. It's like, actually, no, the decline in sales has been horrible. Decline in, so much of with young adult books and children's books, so much of the job has to do with visiting schools and libraries. All of that's gone. My speaking agents who are in charge of kind of putting me in schools have shared some statistics with me across the board of how all of those appearances have gone down. And so it really is this, there's this chilling effect of like creating a culture of fear where people stop living and just exist because they don't know what to do. And I did this interview on book bans recently, and I had said, like, because someone asked, like, has it made you reconsider what you're going to write as far as your books, like, because you're either afraid or because you need to make money? And I was like, well, I'm actually in a unique position in that I make all my real money in TV. Like, I make a lot more money in television than I do in books. I don't care how much my books sell. Like, I write my books because I want to tell my truth and live. I know that the stories I need to tell can't necessarily be told in Hollywood. I don't expect to make that much money. It's great when I do, but it's not about that. And so I think I'm in this unique position to be like, no, I'm going to double down. And so to me, Exquisite Things is very much me doubling down on everything that these book banners are telling me not to write. It is all about queer rights. It's all about showing young people how history has always done this to us and the pieces of history they're not being taught. And it's also all about hope and connection and love, because we have to remind young people that even in the worst times, our community found that. Like, it's so, when I was interviewing ACT UP members for Like a Love Story, it was always so inspiring to hear them talk about how, although they were grieving their community, they were going to funerals constantly and they were fighting and raging and despondent, they were also going out dancing and cruising and finding love and joy and community. Like, we can have joy even in the worst of times. And young people have to know that. They have to be reminded by those of us who are older and have been through it that it's okay to feel joy even when there's so much pain all around you.
There was another quote that I pulled that was exactly that what you just said, but I
Oh,
can't find it.
really?
Maybe,
Oh my God, what was
yeah, I know. Where is it? It was, I fit so maybe it was this one, but maybe I just read it and didn't write it down. But don't mourn the life you love before it's been taken from you. I
it?
feel like it's like a similar sentiment of like, don't like you gotta.
Yes.
Don't say goodbye. Say, I can't do it justice, but that was
No,
one.
but yeah, but absolutely, because it is really hard. We do struggle with mourning the life we have, because look at what we're going through right now. I mean, the life we thought we had, the direction we thought we were on, where things were getting better for those of us, at least in this country, there were so many incredible things happening in the queer community, in the social justice community. There was a reckoning with our country's history of racism that felt necessary and should be continuing, and hopefully is. That work is of course still being done, but look at what's happening now. It's so easy to start mourning the life we thought we had. Our communities are being attacked. Our artistic institutions are being attacked. I mean, what's happening in terms, for me, there's so many things we could talk about, but the attack on the artistic institutions, on the Smithsonian, on the Kennedy Center, the way that companies, the major corporations and multinational companies that control what art is disseminated in the world because they control the studios and the streamers and the newspapers, the way they've all capitulated to the Trump administration so quickly is alarming. And so, of course, a piece of me is mourning the life I thought I had. I thought we were finally on the right path. But I've been here before. We thought we were on the right path in the 90s. I think about that all the time. The 90s were culturally such a time of optimism, where we were talking about homophobia and racism, and we were making art that was speaking to the issues of the day. And then it felt like it slid down again, and then it came back up. This is a cycle. It's like once you're older, you're like, oh, I've seen this before. So I'm. Yeah, so I can't let it bring me down, and I hope that whoever reads the book feels that same feeling of no, we have to lean toward love and community and expression. We can't exist, we must live.
I have a note. It's not in quotation, so I don't know if it's an exact quote, but I pulled it from somewhere after reading the book. Just, and it's exactly what you're saying, which is like permission to live in and feel joy. And it's like we do, I think, as like the elder queers, it's like it's our responsibility to show and communicate what you just said, which is, we've been here before and we survived. A lot of us, God willing, survived, and we'll keep showing up for each other, and that's all we can do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and if we do that, we've done our part. We've been active members of our communities and our society, and that's all we can do.
When was your first book ban, and what did it feel like?
That's a good question. I can't give you an exact answer, but I believe it was couple years ago, maybe 3 years ago. I mean, I do remember what it felt like. That I can speak to more with more specificity, because it felt horrible. And because I'm somebody who is generally very measured, and I don't let things rattle me, and I kind of can move through the world not allowing myself to be destabilized by the forces that try to destabilize us. And I usually then like go into my journaling and my writing and process the world. But with the book banning, it felt so personal. Like I would go on Twitter, and there was a phase, and I remember it very well because it was during our kids' spring break, and we were in New York with my family, which was just like a very odd environment to be in, because I love my family so much, but they're not like that communicative when it comes to these issues. The Iranian way is less kind of like emotionally excavating than I am. And so a lot of what was happening was hard to discuss. And I would go on Twitter, and there would be some pretty prominent people had somehow, as like a love story started to be banned, had latched onto it. And like this woman who I believe is running, she's some kind of like councilwoman or assemblywoman in Texas, had like created these graphics that took passages from the book, like in many cases one line, that were sexual, to kind of accuse me of being a pornographer, a pedophile. You know, they're making these really broad assumptions based on, you know, one line. And so, and then people would pile on, you know, because when prominent people, and then this former CBS and Fox News journalist also piled on. And, you know, she is someone who, in addition to attacking my book, has, you know, is an HIV denialist and was spreading disinformation about that. So, I mean, which, by the way, we have an HIV denialist in running our country's health right now, so Lord knows what we're in for. But you know, I knew that these people were not substantive intellectual minds, but at the same time, they were people with platforms who had a lot of followers who would then take it upon themselves to attack me, send me messages, wishing me death, or in many cases, there was a lot of like, go back to Iran and see what they do with you there and try doing this again. I'm like, which is always such a weird statement for me when people say that, because I'm like, you're by saying go back to Iran and see what they do to you there as a gay person, you're kind of saying that you think Iran's a bad place for how they treat gay people, and yet you want to do the same thing to me here. Like, I don't understand. Like, on the one hand, it makes no logical sense. But what I remember most emotionally is that I was very upset and angry, and that I would try to respond. Like, I would go online and I would try to defend myself and my work, and I would feel angry and I would feel scared, and I was destabilized. And like I said, that doesn't happen easily. And so I think in a lot of ways, the book banning brought me back to how I felt when I was a teenager before I had come out, when I did feel immense fear and shame and wanted to lash out. And eventually, I basically deleted everything from my social media, from Twitter at least, which is where most of it was happening. I just wiped out my Twitter. I barely go on there anymore. And I realized my job was to not let this destabilize me, to stop interacting with people who were directly messaging me about the bans, because no good could come from it, and that they didn't deserve my anger or my emotions. Like, the people who deserve that are my community. And so, and that's so much of where Exquisite Things came from, was I remember after that spring break in New York when the book banning started, I did do one of my London trips. And that's where a lot of the book finally came to me. And it, to me, it's such a, I feel so lucky that I have writing as an outlet, because if I didn't, of course, writing is also what brought the book banners to me. But you know, for people who don't have an outlet, it's like, find an outlet, because if I wasn't able to pour this into a story, I don't know what I would have done with all that emotion. It was really, really hard. Very personally hard. And what I'm happy about is there was a brief moment where I feel like I let the book banners get to me, and I did behave in ways that aren't in sync with my values. Like, I was being kind of snarky online and trying to respond and trying to fight. And I'm like, but that's not who I am. I'm not somebody who believes that that's how we make the world better. You know, I believe we make the world better by sharing our hearts and inviting people through to a generous exchange of ideas, not through fighting and screaming. And so I'm so happy that even though I almost fell to the other side, I pulled myself back and said, no, I'm not going to let you turn me into another version of you. I'm not you. You guys are the ones who attack people. I'm here sharing with openness and a hand that is open to all.
Yeah, I love that. That what you just said reminds me of meditation, of like the awareness and being able to
Yes.
redirect back to the like what you want to be focusing on.
Yes.
I'm obviously a big fan of meditation, so it's
I am too. I meditate too.
like
I've been working so much that I feel like my all my self-care has gone out the window because I'm working like TV production hours, which are so intense that you just come home and you sleep. That's it. But I use the Headspace app mostly because I love that man's British voice. I have a very I my whole thing with like Britain and Ireland, I don't know what it is. I like download books read by Irish and British narrators and just listen to it to go to bed. Like I have an odd thing where I just need to hear those accents. But I find that it's like
I
when
love
I'm
that.
meditating, I don't know if anyone uses the Headspace app, but it's like the core voice is this British man and like it helps me meditate somehow.
Look, we like what we like. We don't have to explain. We don't have to explain ourselves.
I know. I know. I feel very, yes. But Ireland probably is the most Irish. Oh, Irish voices. Andrew Scott, the Irish actor, reads James Joyce's The Dubliners on tape. And if anyone, that is my like, that's my sleep. He reads me to sleep so often. I just put it on. I've listened to it
That's nice.
many times. It's beautiful. Who wouldn't want Andrew Scott to read them to sleep?
True. Speaking of that, I just was yesterday I changed my Siri voice to Irish.
You did.
And I'm not even just lying. I literally did. I don't know, can you see it? It says Irish voice one.
I love it. I don't have a Siri voice because I don't think I've ever used Siri.
Oh, I like started using it. Now I can't stop. It's just like it's mostly like Siri. Like, well, I don't want to like disturb her right now. But like, I'll like, what's the weather? You know, what time is the Ohio State game? What song is this? Those are like the main things I use Siri for. But like, having them like respond, and then it had been South African. I was like, it's time for a change, and I picked Irish.
I love it. Irish, oh, I love, but I have a whole Irish thing. I have an Irish fixation, Irish writers, Irish musicians, the culture. I feel it's a really interesting thing. I've talked to other friends of mine from the kind of Middle East and Arab world, although I guess Middle East, there's a great video going around about how just the term the Middle East is kind of so problematic and colonialist, and we should just say West Asia, which I think is very true. But anyway, I was talking to other friends of mine from the region, and we realized we all shared an obsession with Ireland and its art. And I think it's because when you think, for those of us who grew up in the West, like I moved to the West when I was 2, we went to France, Canada, and the US. And when you grow up in the West and you don't really see anything that feels like it matches your culture, history, but the closest is Ireland. And so I always felt like I would read Irish books or see Irish movies or, you know, hear the music. And I'm like, that feels close to what I'm feeling. And so we started to piece together that there was this connection to Ireland because within the Western world, they felt like the closest to what we felt. And I love it there.
That's cool.
I love it. I was long ago. I went actually when I was writing Exquisite Things because so much of it deals with Oscar Wilde and the first kind of the first time period Exquisite Things immerses the reader in is London in 1895 during Oscar Wilde's trial for gross indecency. And the thing that makes the boys immortal in the story is the burning of the original manuscript of Oscar Wilde's Dorian Gray. And it's burned by the main character's homophobic father, which is this like statement on book banning and the burning of books, and how you can try to burn our books, but in the end, it'll only make us more powerful and more immortal. I mean, that was what I was going for. But Wilde, of course, is Irish and was my first literary obsession. And so I decided to go to Dublin to kind of chase his ghost, which sounds so absurd, but that's how my brain works. And I just had the most inspiring trip there. Like, and Oscar Wilde is everywhere in Dublin. I mean, everywhere you go, there's statues of him and plaques about like he worked in this. This is the pub where he worked, and this is where he lived. And I got to tour the house where he grew up and just sit in the spaces he sat in and feel his energy as I was writing those pages and contemplating his legacy. And it was so amazing. And one thing I will say about Ireland that I love is I've never been to a place where writers are so prominent. I Everywhere you go, it's Wilde, it's Joyce, it's just like they are so proud of their literary heritage, and they have a writer's museum there, and I got to visit when I was in Dublin. And one thing that moved me so much is there was a whole section devoted to young adult writers and how young adult writers were doing the work that James Joyce was doing in his time now. And I feel, as a young adult writer who I hope is doing important work, that there is a real, bless you. Are you about to sneeze? Bless you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I feel like in the US and in so many countries, there's such a like snobbery toward young adult and children's authors. Like, I feel like so many of the gatekeepers of the literary establishment like don't take us seriously and kind of treat us like we're not serious artists who are doing important work. And when I saw that in Ireland, it just meant so much because to me, I love reading everything. I read adult fiction, I read literary fiction, I read young adult, I read genre, I read romance. I'm very vast. And I often feel like when I think about like James Baldwin, who's my biggest literary hero, and how he said that artists are here to disturb the peace, and how that's our work, that's our job as artists. It's like, well, who's doing that right now? Like, who's being banned? Who's alive? Because so many times when we talk about banned books, we go back to like the books, we talk about like To Kill a Mockingbird all the time. And I'm like, you know what? That's great. I want To Kill a Mockingbird to be read forever. But at the same time, who are the artists who are alive, who are dealing with the book bans directly right now? It's young adult and children's authors. Like, we are the ones. And many of us are not backing down. We are continuing to do the work despite the threats, despite the fact that it's harder to get published and sales are down. And we're saying, no, we're not going to leave this behind because the readers deserve it. The world deserves art that's speaking to the moment. So, yeah, it was Ireland to me is a place that's very special. And going to that museum and seeing young adult authors put in conversation with James Joyce, who I love, was very moving.
It's amazing. I love that. Ireland is on my list of places to go, and
Oh, you gotta go.
I would love to, and I will soon, one day. We have the opportunity to hear you speak in person if everyone is in New York City, whoever is here, on Friday, September 26th at 6 p.m. at Book of Wonder in the city. It's free. I'll put the link to register in my bio so folks can register to come and hear you speak. And you're going to be in
Please do.
conversation with
David
David.
Levithan.
Thank
David
you.
Levithan. They're real. I will just say, for those who don't know, a true, when I talk about how like young adult and children's book authors are doing such vital work, David Levithan is a groundbreaking author. David's book, Two Boys Kissing, which is just such an artful young adult book dealing with AIDS and our history of trauma, is one of the most groundbreaking books I've ever read and was inspiring to me and a whole generation of queer authors. David's also been one of the key authors behind Authors Against Book Bans, an organization that's author-led that I wish I had more time to be involved in. But David and Adib Horam and Samira Ahmed and a whole list of authors have really, Gail Forman, I mean, there's so many, have spearheaded that organization into something really special. And anyone who wants to learn more about book bans should look that organization up and join the cause.
Okay, really good to know about that also. I want to talk to you forever, but that's not possible in this moment. I was like been figuring out how I want to close these like shorter catch-up sessions. And I guess what I just would like to know the most is where are you finding joy right now? Like where are you finding the joy that keeps you going right now?
Well, I mean, I always find the most joy with my children. And I will broaden that to say with all young people, it is such a privilege to be a parent to young people and to get to spend time with them and their friends, because youth is inherently hopeful. They have a lot of life ahead of them, and they view the world in a way that is less jaded than us because they haven't seen it as much. And so just to be with them and to dance and laugh and talk about music and culture and connection, and to visit schools and see the next generation and their passion. I often feel like when I talk to people my age who don't spend time with young people, they're so doom and gloom about the next generation. They act as if everything is falling apart. And I'm like, have you spent time with teenagers? They're awesome right now. Like, they're so cool. They're so funny. Their sense of humor is sharp and witty, and they take the piss out of everything in culture, but at the same time, they're passionate about social justice and issues. I mean, I get so much joy out of spending time with them. And I mean, that would be my primary one. And then I always just get so much joy from art. I mean, music especially. I feel like anytime I discover a new artist that I didn't know who like immerses me, I feel young again. You know, like right now there's an Irish artist named C-Mat. I don't know if you've discovered C-Mat yet, but if you haven't, your world rocked. You are gonna go listen to C-Mat when we stop talking. But any artist, like I just discover a new artist and I feel like, oh, it's like there's this joyful feeling of like, wow, we as humans are capable of creating the most beautiful things. And that brings me joy.
Oh, there's so much joy in that, and I also love discovering new music because sometimes I can get caught in a I don't know if I call it a rut, but like I just listen to the same thing over and over, and then I'm just like, wait, there's not, but it feels like an infinite amount of music where it's like just forever amounts of music. And same with books. It's like there's so many books. Sometimes it feels a little overwhelming, but like it's okay.
Oh God. But when you read a book that you want to share with everyone, like recently I read a book called The Safe Keep. Have you read The Safe Keep? Gonna lose your mind. But like, you know, I read that book and then I start sharing it. I tell all my friends, like, oh, this is a mind-blowing book. And then they read it and they text you and they're like, oh my, like my friend just texted me and she's like, thank you for this recommendation. I left it on the coffee table and my mom picked it up and then she read it and she's upset. And then art creates connection, and when that happens, I feel such joy because through art, which comes from the human spirit, we then feel more connected to other human spirits. That is so beautiful. And I do really believe when it comes to music, I have said this to all my friends, I am almost 50. A lot of my friends only listen to music from when we were young. There are studies about how important it is to listen to new music. It is, in addition to like making you feel joy, actually, in terms of your brain like has to process new sounds and be in touch with new things. And I genuinely think there's a correlation between people who don't engage with what's happening in culture now and how despondent or unhappy they feel about the state of the world. And despite the fact that I feel really alarmed about the state of the world, I have not lost my joy. And I think a lot of that is because I'm in touch with what young people are creating, and I love it. And I see their passion and their intelligence and their humor.
I love that. That's amazing. Abdi, thank you for joining. Everyone, pre-order Exquisite Things. Go to your local queer-owned bookstore and order it from them.
Yes.
And if you're in New York, come join us. Us, I'm saying, because I'm going to be there fangirling in the audience on the 26th at Book of Wonder. Abdi, thank you for coming out and thank you for being my friend.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for coming.